Ah, much better. Right, okay. So, why did we put this presentation into the conference? Well, we get lots of questions about TLS on the Tomcat mailing lists. We've always got lots of questions about TLS on the Tomcat mailing list, and they always seem to be of a similar sort of nature, and they indicate that people are struggling with TLS. They're trying to set it up, it's not working, they don't know why. And it's pretty obvious they don't really understand what they're trying to do. Now, if you're trying to debug something you don't understand it, that's a whole lot harder than debugging something that you do understand. And TLS is hard enough to debug in the first place, let alone trying to do it if you don't actually understand what's going on. So the idea behind this presentation is to sort of explain the basics of TLS. So hopefully, should you ever be in a position where, okay, I've got this certificate and a bunch of files and I need to get Tomcat configured, you've got a better idea of what you need to do, how you need to do it, and what might be going wrong. I will try and use TLS. I've already failed on that. Managed to switch to SSL once, and certainly the Tomcat docs will use SSL and TLS interchangeably. Really, TLS is just a newer version of the SSL protocol. It was SSL2, less said about that the better, then 3, TLS 3, SSL3 and TLS 1.0, subtle differences, and then there's TLS 1.1 and 1.2, and 1.3 is on the way. So we're going to start with some cryptography basics. And we'll talk about the individual building blocks, the different elements of cryptography that go up to make the TLS protocol and how it works. And then we'll look at how you configure Tomcat to do TLS. In terms of questions, I'm happy to take questions at any point as we go along and just get my attention somehow and ask away. So, cryptography basics then. We're going to start with symmetric encryption. So, this is where we have piece of plain text, unencrypted text. We encrypt it with an algorithm and a private key, and that gives us our ciphertext. If we want to get back from the ciphertext to our plain text, we need ciphertext, we need a private key, we need an algorithm that might be the same as this algorithm, it might be an inverse of it, but then the two are easily derivable from the other. Ciphertext, private key, gives you the plain text. So that's the state of cryptography up to broadly, 1970-ish. And then at which point, independently, first in the UK, asymmetric encryption was discovered. And then the story goes, I'm not sure how true this is, but some folks at GCHQ were on their way back to GCHQ from a meeting in London. GCHQ is in Cheltenham, it's in the west of England, if the trains are working, about a 2-hour train journey, so more like a 4-hour train journey away on most days. And they were discussing it, and they came up with this idea, and they were furiously scribbling on the tablecloth in front of them. Then they got to Cheltenham and realised that they now had a top secret tablecloth, which they promptly folded up and took off. I have never been able to find the tablecloth. I don't know whether it exists, but it's a nice story. Anyway, the idea with asymmetric encryption is we actually have two keys now. We'll call them A and B to start with. And the idea is if you encrypt with key A, you have to use key B to decrypt. If you encrypt with key B, you have to use key A to decrypt. So you use different keys for encryption and decryption. Now there's a mathematical relationship between A and B. It is theoretically possible to derive one from the other, but it's mathematically very, 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 very hard. And if things are working properly, we're in the realms of all the computers on the planet for a couple of centuries at least, and then only on a good day with the following wind. So yes, it's possible. Practically, it shouldn't be. If the algorithms are implemented correctly, then practically it's not. It's secure at the moment. Now, what we do with asymmetric encryption is we take our keys A and B, we call one of them the public key, which we publish widely, put it up on the internet, put it on our business cards, and then there's a private key, which we look after. So that's the one that lives on the USB key, in the safe, in the locked room, with the armed guards in front of it, or depending on your level of paranoia. So the way this works is we start with our plain text, we encrypt it with the algorithm and our public key,
and we get our ciphertext. And if I've got the ciphertext and the public key, short of doing some incredible mathematical gymnastics, can't get back to the plain text. The only way to get from the ciphertext to the plain text is with the private key.
So the idea here is I can put my public key out on the internet. Anybody can take a message, encrypt it with my public key, and then I'm the only one who can read it. Because I'm the only one, hopefully, if I've been looking after my key properly, who's got access to the private key. So I'm going to take the ciphertext, private key, and I can decrypt it, but nobody else can. You can also do it the other way around. And why you would want to do this will become apparent in a bit. If I take a piece of plain text and I encrypt it with my private key, and then I publish that ciphertext and that plain text, I've proved that text has come from me. And the reason I've proved it is you can take the ciphertext, you can take my public key that's out there on the internet, and you can decrypt that ciphertext with my public key, and you'll get the plain text. And because you've decrypted it with my public key, it must have been encrypted with my private key, which hopefully I have got, which means it must have come from me. Technical term is non-repudiation. It must have come from me. So that becomes important when we start doing digital signing. Right. Next thing I want to look at is hash functions. So Chris was talking a little bit about these when he was talking about password and credential handlers this morning. We're looking at it from a slightly different slant. So essentially a hash function is something you take a plain text, you run it through the hash function, and you get a hash or a fingerprint out. And a good hashing algorithm has a couple of characteristics. First of all, a small change in the input should mean a large change in the output. And the reason you want that is it needs to be very difficult to generate an input that gives you a particular hash, because you're trying to use these hashes as fingerprints to have them uniquely linked to this document. If I could generate any document I like with a given hash, or if I could generate a document with a given hash, then you'd start doing all sorts of nasty things, which is why we're not overly keen on MD5 these days, because you can do that now. So, if we take that symmetric and asymmetric encryption and signatures, before we do that, I've forgotten something important. Let's just go back. This has all sorts of advantages, not least of which, go back one more, the normal case, not least of which, I'm not publishing any secrets anywhere. So it's my public key, which is perfectly safe to be out there, anybody can encrypt stuff and send it to me. This does have a big disadvantage. Compared to symmetric encryption, it's a lot slower. So when you start needing to make trade-offs between performance and security and ease of use, the disadvantage of asymmetric encryption is it is slower. So, and it's slow enough that it's going to cause performance problems if you try and do everything asymmetrically. So we find a way around that in TLS, which I will talk about a little bit later. Right, back to our hash functions and digital signatures. So, right. To further prove, this is sort of taking what I was saying on the previous slide a step further, that something came from me. So I take a piece of plain text. Rather than encrypting the entire plain text with my private key, I'll take a hash and I'll encrypt that with my private key to give me an encrypted hash. Now, because of the nature of the hash function, that should be as good as encrypting the plain text. But if I then take the plain text and the encrypted hash function, put them together, that's effectively my digital signature. And somebody who receives that email, for example, can take the email, they can generate the hash for the email. They can take the encrypted hash that was provided with the email, they can decrypt it with the public key, and if the public key produces the same hash, then again we know that, okay, so Mark's public key produced that hash, which means that hash must have been encrypted with Mark's private key, which means this encrypted hash must have come from Mark, which means that hash must have came from Mark, which means this came from Mark. So you can trace it back to me, or whoever sent it, to know that where it came from. So what we're saying there is the public key decrypted it. That means the private key must have created it. Therefore, whoever owns the private key must have sent it. So that's great, but all we've really done is we've just moved the goalposts. Now what we have to figure out is, okay, so whoever owns that private key sent it. How do I know who owns the private key? That's our next problem. And we use certificates as a way. There are several ways of doing this, but because we're thinking about it in the context of TLS, we're going to talk about certificates. So, if we take my identity and my public key and combine them in a document, hash them, get something which I'm going to call a certificate authority to sign it and create an encrypted hash, then by the same mechanism for validating a digital signature, you can ensure that the ID and the public key that's provided to that certificate authority is indeed the ID and public key that was provided. Now, what you're now reliant on is that that certificate authority has somehow verified that that ID is correct and that is a valid public key. And then that happens completely outside of technology. That's where you play games from anything as simple as proving you own an email address to the rather more complicated problem of trying to get a certain certificate authority to authenticate the Apache Software Foundation by trying to call our phone number of our head office, which we don't have. Which is a little bit of a problem. So we ended up jumping through all sorts of hoops trying to get our certificates last time round because the certificate authorities wanted to use telephone validation and we don't have an office. I think we have a phone in Jim's basement, which I don't think is plugged in most of the time. I think it just hits an answer machine. So that can cause a few problems. And there are other ways of doing it. You can check public records. One way that a number of them use is, because these are normally to do with websites, they'll look up the registration information for your domain name and then contact the contact email address associated with the domain name and say, is this person allowed to request a certificate for that address? So there are different ways of doing it. And there are differing rules about how much validation they need to put in place and how often they need to do it. But ultimately, what they're validating is that that ID and that public key are associated, and then they sign it with their private key to prove it. And essentially, the combination of the ID, or my ID, my public key, and the encrypted hash that they've signed, that becomes my certificate. So, but again, all we've actually done is move the goalposts a bit further. Because to validate the certificate authority signature, you need to be able to link their public key to their identity. And you do that with the certificate as well. And you then get a chain of trust. But we end up with a turtles all the way down situation. Yeah. The world is on four elephants, sat on top of a turtle. What's a turtle on top of another turtle? What's that turtle on top of another turtle? And it's turtles all the way down. We just get this chain of certificates. Proving that ultimately we need to get to something called a root certificate, and that's from a root certificate authority, and there are several of those. DigiCert, Symantec, Let's Encrypt, and they're effectively self-signed, so you need some other mechanism in order to trust that root certificate authority. Now, they're usually installed by the operating system. So you're then trusting that your operating system vendor has somehow verified that these certificates are valid. You can manually validate the certificates against the root certificate authority's website. That's great, but, and there's a big but, if you do it over HTTP, well, that's subject to a man-in-the-middle attack, so that's no good. Anybody can inject any certificate. That doesn't work. You could do it over TLS. Great, do it over TLS, but then we need to verify their identity with a certificate. Trust chain and a root certificate. So, we've hit the same problem again. There isn't really a great solution. What it comes down to is you sort of hope that if Somebody's managed to put a fake certificate on a certificate authority's website, they're going to notice. So if it hasn't changed over a period of a couple of weeks, it's probably valid. If it's changed in the last 5 minutes, I might be a little wary myself. Just give it. But it's a fundamental problem of how do you build trust against remotely disconnected entities. It's not perfect, but it's a lot better than doing nothing. So we get this change certificate. This is your certificate. These are normally called intermediate certificates, and that's the root certificate. So we can put all of this together to create TLS. So a TLS connection is initiated by a handshake. There are mandatory steps, there are optional steps. I'm going to talk about the sort of common, usual, normal, basic. The protocol continually sees enhancements. There are things that happen to make it more secure, ways it does things. I'm going to gloss over, stroke ignore some of that, and just talk about the basics, just to give you enough of an understanding so you know what bits you've got and what bits you need where to make this work when you're trying to set it up. So, where do we start? Well, the starting point is we have a user who has a bunch of certificate authorities that they trust and a bunch of ciphers and algorithms and stuff that it understands. And there's a number of factors there, but broadly, the important ones are the cipher suites it understands and the TLS protocols it's going to accept. There are other things as well, but those are the key ones. And I'm just going to bracket that all in sort of algorithms and stuff, or ciphers and stuff. Server has a private key, it has its own certificate, and it has its own set of ciphers, algorithms, and stuff that it understands. So that's where we start. And the first thing that happens is that the client wants to create a connection to the server, so the client sends what's known as the client hello across to the server. It's generated a random number, and it sends to the server that random number, and these are the list of algorithms, ciphers, and stuff that I understand. That gets sent to the server. Server makes a note of those. It generates its own random number, and it then compares. Need to stop standing on that. It compares what it understands, what the client understands, and basically works out, right, which algorithm, which cipher are we going to talk? And I'm going to send that information and my random number back to the client. So the client has now got the server's random number, its random number, which we already had. We've got the agreed algorithm, ciphers, and stuff. And next, we have the certificates. So the server sends its certificate to the client. The server says, yeah, right, I've finished my hello bit. I've sent you all of the initial stuff. I'm done. Then what happens is that the client when it receives the certificate, you can go back a step. Yeah, really, when the server says it, the client's going to validate it. And if it doesn't validate, it's going to reject it at this point. So what it's doing there is it's going to look at the certificate, it's going to see who signed it. Do I recognise the identity of that signer? Is it in my list of trusted authorities? If not, work my way up the list of signees until I get to what I trust. That's why it's important that the server actually doesn't just provide its certificate, it needs to provide the entire certificate chain. Because the client has no way of walking up that chain unless the server provides it. So if the server really needs to provide the entire chain all the way up to the root. And then the server will work its way up that chain, checking that, okay, this is the server certificate, who signed it, they did it, this is the certificate, yep, they signed it. Check everything's valid, up to a root, and hopefully it trusts the root. And as long as it trusts the root or one of the intermediate certificates, the client will accept it. Right, okay. So what happens next? So the client generates something called the pre-master secret, encrypts it, using the server's public key, which is part of the certificate, and sends it to the server. So this is really the first point where we have what might be viewed as sensitive security information transiting the network, but at this point it is encrypted, with asymmetric encryption using the server's public key. The client, having sent that to the server, takes the random number it generated, the random number the server generated, and the pre-master secret, combines them to create what's known as the master secret, and then it switches to encrypted mode. But at this point, it's going to switch to encrypted mode using symmetric encryption, and this is where we get our performance. So what we've done up to here is we've used asymmetric encryption to exchange a secret, a shared secret, effectively. So the master secret is a shared secret that the client and the server both know, but, critically, hasn't crossed the network in plain text. So an eavesdropper, all the eavesdropper has got is the encrypted pre-master secret, which hopefully they can't decrypt, and the random numbers. And that's not enough to get you to the master secret. So the client then says to the server, right, I'm going to change cipher specs now. So you remember that algorithm we agreed all the way back in step two? So our cipher and our algorithm that we agreed here, I'm going to switch to that now, and I'm going to use this as my key. And then it says, right, as far as the handshake's concerned, I'm done. I'm ready to start talking encrypted. On the server side, the server decrypts the pre-master secret. So it's now got the unencrypted version. It does the same combination of server's random number, client's random number, pre-master secret to generate the master secret. And then it too is ready to switch to encrypted mode using the agreed algorithm, using the key, and it sends a message to the client. And then we're finished, and we're at a point where we can have encrypted communication. So we've got the algorithm we agreed in step two, it's symmetric, and we're using the master secret as a key. So the bits that are really important here are the server's private key, the server's certificate, and the algorithms and ciphers that the server accepts. That's sort of the starting information, that's the key information that when you're configuring Tomcat to support TLS that you need to set up. Now there are some extensions to this which I will mention briefly. First of all, client certificate authentication. In the same way that the server sent a client a certificate to prove its identity, the client can send one to the server as well. I didn't show that in the diagram. It works exactly the same way. The server has a list of certificates it trusts. Again, it works its way up the certificates that have been provided by the client to either find one it trusts. Server name indication, I talked about that this morning when I was talking about new stuff in 8.5. The reason this is important is normally in the HTTP protocol, you don't know what server the client wants to connect to until you get the HTTP request line, because that's where the host name is. Might even be in a host header one line down, but let's assume it's in the first packet. But that doesn't happen until all of this certificate exchange has gone on, which is why, if you're doing virtual hosting, you've got lots of different server names over here. There needs to be a way in this mechanism for the client to say to the server, I want to talk to www.openoffice.org, so you get the openoffice.org certificate going back, rather than saying, I want to talk to tomcat.apache.org, so you get the star.apache.org certificate going back. So that's why you need this protocol extension SNI to insert the server name information in so the right certificate can go back. Because by the time the HTTP protocol starts, it's too late. And the other one is application layer protocol negotiation. This is particularly used by HTTP 2. And what this has done is it recognised that in HTTP 2, there was a bit of a handshake to start off, just to make sure that both client and server could understand HTTP 2, and if they couldn't, it would fall back to HTTP 1.1. Well, given that HTTP 2 doesn't quite, but pretty much requires TLS, somebody had the bright idea, well, hang on a minute. Rather than doing all of this handshake stuff to set up the TLS connection, then do another handshake to work out whether or not ALPN is supported, why don't we just slip in amongst this handshake which protocols the client supports and which protocols the server supports, and basically let them agree the protocol as part of the handshake. And what that lets you do is basically reduces the number of round trips. So it lets you set up the connection that little bit quicker. You can dive basically straight into HTTP2 rather than having to do an HTTP upgrade from HTTP 1.1 to HTTP2 to start it off. So it lets your connection start that little bit faster. And there has been talk about doing similar things with other protocols as well. WebSocket was mentioned. I haven't checked on it lately to see whether there's been any progress on that. I think some of the mail protocols were looking at it as well. So that's the basics of what's going on. How do you get this working in Tomcat? Well, I said you have some requirements. You need a private key, you need the server certificate, and you need the certificate chain. And that's going to be configured all in server.xml. Now, where things get interesting is you fill in your request to your certificate provider for your certificate, provide them whatever information they ask you for, doing whatever, following whatever instructions they give you, and they give you back a bunch of files. Meanwhile, you've looked online and you found some instructions of how to set up Tomcat for TLS. I pretty much guarantee that the format of the files in those instructions are not the format of the files that your certificate authority has just given you. That's nearly always the first question we get. I've got these PEM files and the instructions I'm looking at say I need a key store, or I've got these DIR files and how do I convert? So what have you actually got? So if you've got a .pem, a .crt, .sir or .key, it's almost certainly an ASCII text file with some combination of key, certificate and or chain in it. It can have any or all of them, potentially. If you've got a .der file, that's just a binary form of that. These are quite nice because you just open them up in a text editor and you can see each block. Oh, there's a block for that, block for that, block for that. They've got nice headers and footers. They're very easy to follow, very easy to see what you've got. And I like PEM files. P7B, that's almost certainly PKCS7. Again, that's ASCII. Again, you can open it up. But that's then combined in one single block. And what you've got there is the certificate and the chain. There's never a private key in one of these files. It's just the certificate and the chain file. Another possibility is P12. That's binary, so no hope of being able to look at that and make any sense of it. Again, it's normally would have key and cert, probably chain. It can just have a cert and a chain in it, although Java accepted it if it had all three of them up at one level, and I think 7 accepts it with all three, and then 8 will accept it with just the chain. There's some, or it's two versions, it's a version earlier, it's something like that anyway. There is a difference between Java versions in there somewhere. So, bearing in mind, these have been around for quite a while, which of these standard formats does Java use? It doesn't, it creates its own. So we've got the Java key store. It's binary. It's Java specific. You can have any combination of key, cert, and chains. It's also, it's got better to work with. But for example, it used to be something on the command line. Could you put a key in and you couldn't get it out, or you could get it out and you couldn't put it in? I think you could put it in, but you couldn't get it out. It
was difficult to get out.
Yeah, you can do it with code, but doing it on the command line is fun. So there's all of these different formats, and prior to Tomcat 8.5 it was a bit of a nightmare, because if you're using the NIO or NIO2 connections, which are based on Java SSE, JSSE, you needed to use the key store. If you're using OpenSSL, you needed them in this format. Now, converting between any of these except JKS is fine. OpenSSL will do that for you. There's a million and one guides on the interwebs how to do it. Very easy. That was fine. You can normally get to the PEM files if you didn't get them quite easy. And given that that's what HTTPD uses, then most certificate authorities will give you an option to have it back in that format anyway. So that was normally quite easy. Where it got really difficult was you'd started off over here, then you'd realised that your GSSE performance wasn't as good as you wanted, and you wanted to switch to API native, which means you needed to get from there to there, which was not so easy. It's doable. If you look on the Tomcat website, left-hand side, presentations, click on that, get a list of presentations. There's one from me about setting up TLS, and it's literally a script that you can practice, you can just about copy and paste. Depending on which platform you'll use, you'll have to change the direction of the slashes, but you can copy and paste it, you can create your own certificate authority, you can create certificates, you can move between these formats, all the plans you need are there, all the Tomcat configuration you need is there to set it up and start playing with this. But that was still rather more difficult than we really wanted it to be. So, yeah, 7 or 8, BIO, NIO, NIO 2 is only an 8.5, isn't it? Yeah, so BIO, NIO, how to use GSSE, how to use the key store. As of Java 7, it got a little bit better. You can use the PKCS 12. 7 or 8 using API Native, how to use that configuration. And also, and this is sort of one of those things that you look back in hindsight and you think, I wish we hadn't done that. But by the time you realise it, it's way too late. We had completely separate configurations for these. Even when we were configuring the same thing, with possibly the same possible values, the actual configuration attribute had a different name. So it was really awkward to switch from one to the other. As of 8.5, we said, right, we know we're going to have to rejig things significantly to cope with SNI and TLS virtual hosting. So given that we're going to break all the existing configurations anyway, let's break them properly and try and make this easier for people to use. And actually, we've been a little bit nicer than that, which I'll come on to in a second. But as of Tomcat 8.5, KeyStore, PKCS 12, PEM, don't care. Use JSSE configuration style or OpenSSL configuration style, don't care. Where we can actually use common attribute names, we have. Where they are JSSE specific or OpenSSL specific, they have specific attribute names. And what you can't do is use the JSSE, have a JSSE attribute there and an OpenSSL attribute there. That's a no-no. You've got to pick one set or the other, but it doesn't matter which configuration style you use, you can still have either implementation. So if you want, you can have a Java key store configured with all the JSSE configuration, and you can configure it to use the OpenSSL implementation, and we'll do the conversions on the fly. And it's therefore so much easier to swap from one connector to the other. So if you want to swap from JSSE to OpenSSL, just switch the implementation attribute, leave the configuration the same. You don't need to convert your certificates anymore. The one caveat is if you want to use API native, you're still stuck with you've got to use PEM. So we've done this in the Java connectors, so you've got all that flexibility there. In API native, you have to use the OpenSSL configuration. That could theoretically be changed. Patch is welcome. I didn't say it was easy. So if we look back at what this configuration actually looks like in Tomcat then, back in Tomcat 7 or 8, the BIO or NIO, it would look like this. The only difference, if it was BIO, you wouldn't have BIO there, it would just be the HTTP 11 processor. The thing to keep an eye on is this one here. Note SSL protocol with SSL in lowercase. If we switch to API native, and lo and behold, SSL protocol, this bit is now uppercase. Okay, the configuration style is different as well, but it was things like that that were making translation between the two difficult. So in 7 and 8, because we didn't support virtual hosting for TLS, it was one connector, one host name, one certificate. okay, you could fudge that slightly. It could be one connector, one hostname, one wildcard certificate, or possibly one connector, a handful of hostnames, one certificate with a bunch of subject alternate names in it. But at some point, that was going to fail. And particularly for something like the websites Apache's putting up, we've got so many different sites. You could not get that model to work for the ASF, and we're probably moderately complicated. We're not particularly complicated. I've certainly been on customer sites where it's a lot worse, when there have been acquisitions, and then there's all the stuff that marketing come up with for all the special host names for this campaign, that campaign, but they all need to come back to the same server. That model doesn't really work that well. So, come to Tomcat 859, one connector, many host names as you like, well, 2 to the 32, which is probably enough. And then each host name can have multiple certificates. Now, the reason we've done this is you can actually get different types of certificates. And mostly they're RSA. You can get, is it DSA or DSS?
I can DSA. Remember.
DSA. You can get DSA certificates. They're pretty unusual, but you can get them. And you can get elliptic curve certificates. And what they generally do is open up the range of algorithms that are available to you for encryption. Now, the way new cipher suites are being defined, that's becoming less or more important depending on what's going on. But generally, it might sometimes be useful to have more than one certificate. And Tomcat will now support that. Basically, one certificate of each type. And I said we've been nice. We haven't thrown away the Tomcat 7 and 8 configuration completely. What we've done is if you use the Tomcat 8 style configuration, so this in Tomcat 8.5, what we will do is, under the covers, we'll say, yeah, thank you very much, and we will turn that into a Tomcat 8.5 style configuration with a single virtual host, with a single certificate. But we're only doing that in Tomcat 8.5 and 9. As of Tomcat 10, we will not be supporting that. And I will be very, very happily deleting a huge bunch of code that is doing nothing much more than just copying attributes around the place. That's going to be a very happy day when we get to that point. So, what the Tomcat 8.5 and onwards configuration looks like is you still have your connector, but now we have this SSL host config. So you can have multiple of these host configs nested inside the connector, and you have multiple certificates, normally just one, but you can have multiple nested inside the config. Now, if you had a host name associated with this, the name would go here. If you don't specify a host name, it just uses an internal default. And if you are doing virtual hosting, then you'll need to make sure whatever hosts you configure nested in your engine match up to the host names you configure here. We haven't found a way of nicely linking that up yet, because the two bits are just sufficiently independent that trying to get it synchronized was just messy, difficult, awkward. It's one of those things that I feel there's a clever, nice solution out there somewhere. We just haven't found it yet. I'm sure there is a way of making it work, just don't know. So that's where we are with that. Notice for APR native, the only thing that changes to switch to APR. No, I've done that wrong, haven't I? That won't work because that's JKS and that's going to fail. Right, I'll correct these slides later. What we should have done here is just change, left it on.
That's in the future, you can volunteer to fix that.
Yeah, I'm not going to fix that bug. Yes. So what this will use NIO, JSSE, pure Java. If we then introduce the APR native library, automatically, without changing any of this, it will switch to using the OpenSSL implementation under the covers, and you'll get generally better performance without having to change any of the configuration. If you do want to switch to APR native, that won't work. You'd need to change this to the PEM files as well. But I will fix the slides before I put them up on the Tomcat website. So that brings me to the end of Tomcat TLS. Hopefully it's given you an idea of what the various bits are in the TLS, in the handshake. A couple of things I didn't mention. That handshake process happens in clear text. A few of the bits are encrypted. The actual handshake is in clear text. So if you've got Wireshark, then you can actually look at it and you can see what's going on and you can follow what's going on. If you're feeling particularly brave, you can actually work your way, Wireshark will break it down for you and show you what's going on. But you can check through the protocols and look at the individual bits. But the nice thing is, if the handshake is failing, it gives you a way to dig into what's actually going on. Because you can say, well, client sends these algorithms, server sends that, oh, there's no match, that's why it's not working. Or, well, why isn't this cipher being selected? Well, you can look at what's going on in the handshake and see, it'll give you some ideas. Hopefully you now understand where you need the private key to be, where you need the certificates, and what can go wrong there. The other thing that's actually quite useful if you're seeing misbehaving configuration, particularly if the client is connecting but in a way you don't expect, again, SSL Labs that we mentioned this morning, point SSL Labs at your server and it gives you a full diagnostic of what your server will accept, and that's often quite useful to help you understand, well, why are we negotiating that cipher suite rather than that cipher suite? So that's something else to look at. So I hope that's been useful. Do we have any more questions? Ooh, lots. Start with someone here.
You mentioned performance earlier, but didn't touch on the connectors and how they might compare. How does like the native OpenSSL connector compare to the NIO?
Okay,
in the later versions.
Okay, this will be very roughly, and I'm going to avoid looking at John Frederick because he's going to throw things at me if I get this wrong. Broadly, the JSSE with the OpenSSL implementation versus APR native, it's about the same. Depending on what load you put through it, you'll see slightly different performances, but broad, they're sort of close enough, and they're significantly above JSSE on its own. What it comes down to is with the APR native connector, you're paying a performance price when you cross the Java to native code boundary, and it depends on the load and the profile of your network traffic, how many times you have to cross that boundary. Now, am I doing it a couple of big packets or lots of little packets? It's a little bit around the encryption algorithm that's being used and how that passes stuff. So there's lots of variables, but broadly they're about the same and they're better than JSSE on its own. Certainly to the point that if I was setting up a Tomcat and TLS tomorrow, I'd be using the NIO connector with the OpenSSL TLS implementation. That would be my starting point. And if I changed, it would unlikely to be for performance reasons. The level of differences you're getting, unless you're really, really into an edge case, and you have to quite a long way into an edge case, you're going to be better off spending your time tuning your app and that sort of stuff than you are fiddling around with those sorts of things. Did we schedule that one for this one?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool, excellent. So, John Frederick can go into that in detail. Because there are some subtle differences, aren't there?
Yeah, one of the differences, like if you get the way the socket is handled by OpenSSL, we don't control it that much. By using the NIO connector, we control all data that we provide, and we provide it. OpenSSL is processing in memory, it's processing in the socket. So what we lose in front part, we recover in the other one. Because basically, I'm going a bit forward to my presentation somehow.
So, don't give it all away.
Basically, in fact, we ask OpenSSL to process in memory, and then we read the memory and then copy this memory to the socket. In case you're using the API native connector, then you just need the socket and then OpenSSL will do all the magic.
And there's another question there.
Yeah, the cipher spec, where can you put that configuration?
Right. That would go in the SSL host config. By default, there's a reasonable spec in there anyway. It does vary slightly between Tomcat versions. There's a wiki page that details what the defaults are and how they're likely to behave, and a little bit of the rationale as to why we allow certain things. And in one case, basically, normally we wouldn't allow this, but if we don't allow this, then Java 7 won't have any ciphers at all, so we better allow something. So that kind of information is there, and that gets updated not as often as I would like, but it does get updated. And again, we basically just run tests with OpenSSL labs to see where we get it. But by default, Tomcat should be pretty secure. The other thing is you can now, when you specify the cipher spec, for any of them, you can use the GSSE names or the OpenSSL names or the OpenSSL format with the pluses and the minuses and everything else. Internally, we turn everything to OpenSSL format. So basically what we do, if you give us a list of GSSE names, we just turn it into a list of OpenSSL names and pass it through. But we've got some code internally that we've got a part of unit tests that check that if you use the OpenSSL cipher specs and you put it into Tomcat, you get the same result as you get from the latest OpenSSL code, which is sometimes different depending on which version of OpenSSL you're using, depending on as they fix bugs, add new cipher suites, disable old ones. But we basically keep pace with the latest. So you just need to be aware of that. You might get slightly different behavior between Tomcat and OpenSSL for what's the same cipher spec, but that's because we're effectively working off a different OpenSSL version. Yes?
If I am using NIO or NIO2 and I'd like to use the OpenSSL JSSE provider, which actual libraries do I need on my disk?
You need a version of TC native compiled with OpenSSL.
So you do need TC native? You can't get away with just APR and OpenSSL?
No, not yet. That's on the list of things we'd like to look at for 10. Putting a much... and I'll talk about this more in the wrap-up, but there's a number of things that we could potentially do around reducing the number of connectors and tying things up, but it's all around actually, if we're just going to use OpenSSL in memory with GSSE, there's lots of baggage that we don't need. But you do need the same stuff you would need if you're running the API native connector.
Yeah, the reason I was asking is anyone who's running a reasonably up-to-date Unix distribution has APR and they already have OpenSSL, but they don't have TC native.
Yeah, but you need TC native as well. But if you're on Unix, it's not that difficult to compile compared to Windows, for example. Which, if people are on Windows, by the way, we do have the compilation instructions available now that you can build the API native libraries for Windows with freely available tools without having to spend huge chunks of money with Microsoft or dig through the attic trying desperately to find a copy of Visual Studio 6, which used to be the situation. That's now a lot better. But yeah, Linux is a lot easier to build straight away. Question there.
So I'm getting a little confused here about all the options. The TC native DLL that ships with your Windows distribution,
yes.
What is that?
That is a statically compiled Tomcat native library plus APR plus OpenSSL. And what that enables is it enables to use the APR native connector if you wish, and it enables the OpenSSL engine with the GSSE connectors if you wish. Now, depending on your version of Tomcat, different things will be enabled by default if that library is detected on startup. But you will get nice, clear log messages at the beginning. The other thing we've done in Tomcat startup messages, you're probably familiar with the... you get the HTTP NIO 8080 tag in the logs of the startup when you connect. What you get now, what you used to get was HTTPS NIO 8443. What you'll get now is HTTPS NIO JSSE 8443, or HTTPS NIO OpenSSL 8443. So you know which implementation has actually been used by that connector. So there's enough information in the logs. You say yes, that has worked, as well as all the usual messages about this library is loaded, that library is loaded, and so on. Any more? Okay. Thank you all for your attention.